Welcome to another episode of A People's Theology. I'm the host of A People's Theology, Mason Meninga. In this episode, I talk with Graham Jones. Graham is a writer and organizer around housing and mental health issues, and author of the recently released book, Red Enlightenment, on socialism, science, and spirituality. You can get connected with Graham and his work in the links in the episode description. If you're a fan of A People's Theology, the easiest way to support the podcast is if you gave it a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Tell me what you like about the podcast. Also, it would make my day if you would support my Patreon at patreon.com/Mason Meninga. There are multiple tiers with great rewards, including papers I write and even being listed as a producer. Please enjoy more inspiring and liberating theology. Today, I've got Graham Jones with me, and Graham, you are the author of The Shock Doctrine of the Left, and you've written some other different kinds of publications, but you recently released a book called Red Enlightenment on Socialism, Science, and Spirituality, where we're going to talk about kind of the spirituality and different religious movements in kind of the revolutionary left side of things, and so I'm really excited for the conversation. But before we begin talking about all of that, who is Graham Jones to Graham Jones?
Who is Graham Jones to Graham Jones? Okay, so I guess, well, yeah, you've got your sort of, you know, your on the surface kind of bio stuff. I'm a writer. Mm-hmm. I'm a sort of a lapsed activist that used to be involved in kind of like housing and mental health kind of activism, mm-hmm. more so just concentrating on the writing at the moment. But I guess possibly more relevant to this conversation is if I just sort of get you up to speed with where I'm coming from with regard to like religion and spirituality. Like, so I grew up in a sort of a kind of an ambient Christian context. Mm-hmm. Like my mother's a Catholic, but we weren't like a Christian family. We weren't like, we didn't go to church except for, you know, midnight mass every so often. And the schooling in this country for my generation, it was very much, you know, we're singing hymns, we're listening to Bible readings, Lord's Prayer with our eyes closed, that sort of stuff. So it was kind of like there was a sort of an ambient sort of Christian kind of context, but most people around me weren't really actively religious. I think church attendance in this country has collapsed a lot quicker than it has in other places in the West, like particularly in the United States. But I actually personally was actually quite intense. I had quite an intense sort of belief in God. I had like conversations with God. And I actually remember being sort of mildly bullied by my, not like very harshly, but sort of like mildly ribbed by my classmates for sort of admitting to this kind of thing. They would sort of, I was one of those annoying precocious kids who was like a slightly higher level reader. And so they would give me like the children's Bible to read while everyone else was doing something else. And it was actually quite a big part of how I interacted with the world. Then I got to teenage years and I completely flipped. I became like a hardcore atheist. Was always arguing against the existence of God. It was very sort of scientistic. But then as I reached adulthood, the two of them, neither one ever really won out. And so there was this kind of just conflict between these two sides of me that over the course of my adult life, I started to kind of harmonize. And so I'm now at this kind of point where I've actually kind of returned to sort of thinking of myself as a Christian. And I understand kind of the world through what I, at least what I consider sort of to be a sort of a Christian lens. I think in terms of God, although perhaps my notion of God, many Christians might listen to that and be like, well, that's not God. That's pantheism. That's not real. That's not real Christianity. But I'm fine with that. I'm absolutely fine with that. But it's quite important to me that I'm sort of perceiving the world and understanding it through these more sort of like religious categories that for a chunk of my life I'd completely disowned. So I guess, you know, I'm sure we'll get into more of the detail about it as we go on to the conversation, mm-hmm. but that's just the sort of the broad overview of like, you know, very quickly sweeping through my life story.
Totally. Yeah, that's great. Well, I would imagine to some degree that certainly informs a lot of your research in the book. Because speaking along the lines of the research, obviously you're exploring religion and a little bit of science and certainly socialist kind of revolutionary movements as you write the book. Is there anything that you learned about one of those things, maybe religion, science, or even revolutionary movements or the history of them? Was there anything you learned about one of those things as you wrote the book that you didn't know before? Obviously, if you go into writing a book like this, there's probably some level of, all right, I already know a little bit about this part of religion or this part of science, but I would imagine there's quite a bit of research that goes into a book like this that maybe, and as you're researching, you're like, whoa, did not know about that before.
Yeah, an enormous amount. And to be honest, it was such a long project that's taken up so many years of my life. It's actually quite difficult to piece apart what happened when in the process of writing it. Because like my previous book is actually kind of was technically kind of it kind of came out of the same or the same sort of research. And so yeah, it's an extremely long process, but I guess yeah, lots of things, sort of details around the Haitian slave revolution was like it's quite a big one in the book, but and it's one that the left has talked about a bit more over the last few years. The one really big successful slave revolution, but discovering the role of religion from lots of different angles around then and also in France at the sort of the same time, that was something quite, that was quite new to me. It was quite interesting because you have this a really interesting moment where you've got sort of enlightened like European Enlightenment philosophy is actually being taken up by sort of the leaders of this slave revolution, but they're also sort of, Catholic. And at the same time, you've got on the ground people using voodoo actually as a means of organizing people, like the sort of the it's impossible to kind of really piece apart what is politics and what is spirituality because the two are sort of entwined in how people are organizing on the ground and the role even of like Catholic priests in helping to sort of mediate between sides, all of these kind of things where that just don't that side of the whole that whole event is very rarely sort of talked about. It's usually just talked about in terms of, well, it's the slave revolution, and you might get a hint that there's, oh, actually, it's quite interesting because it was sort of a pro-Enlightenment one where, the Enlightenment is usually sort of kind of attacked, not wrongly necessarily, but is usually just sort of seen only as in how in terms of how it was used for the benefit of like, imperialism rather than how it could sometimes also be used as an anti-imperialist one as well. But that whole role of religion and spirituality in that revolution was actually quite a new thing to me. And it was one of those sort of light bulb moments where I realized this could like tie together lots of different sort of strands.
Yeah, interesting. What was there anything that you learned about yourself as you wrote this book? Again, you kind of have this interesting, complex history with religion yourself. Maybe there was something that was revealed a little bit more as you're writing the book about that particular part of your story, or maybe there's something else. But I'm curious if there's anything that you learned about yourself as you wrote the book.
Yeah, I guess from a different sort of in different sort of ways, like in a sort of because there were I use these kind of memoiry sort of aspects at the start of most of the chapters to sort of like just to introduce the topics, but that just the process of writing that kind of thing to go back through your sort of life history, pick out moments that may have fed into who you became later on. It's almost quite therapeutic, in the sense that when you go to therapy, like a big part of it is not necessarily being told what you're supposed to think, and it's more about allowing you to run through all of the kind of the parts of yourself and the parts of your memories and what you've experienced and try and tie them together into some new narrative. So the whole process of putting this book together of sort of taking disparate moments of your life and actually giving it a concrete kind of form in writing, that in itself was, it felt like I'd become someone slightly different by the end of it. But also in terms of it was actually quite interesting. I think I mentioned a little bit about this in the book, in that there's often this difficulty with intellectualizing spirituality and how that can, if you're not careful, that can have a negative impact on how you actually experience it. sort of in a way where you have to almost kind of completely remove the intellectual side and simply just feel and experience. And through a lot of the writing of the book, I did kind of lose a bit of my sort of spiritual experience, the intensity of my spiritual experience, until at one point, about sort of, you know, three quarters of the way, when the sort of the end was in sight, and suddenly the two kind of came back together again, and being able to sort of mix actual embodied spiritual practices with this kind of quite intense intellectual work, thinking about you know, metaphysics in a very hyper-rational way, they managed to kind of reharmonize, and that was kind of a quite an important moment for me as a person, because it's something that I had struggled with. I would veer from one end to the other, and I never managed to sort of bring the two together. So yeah, I guess in the process of it, I did change and learn things about myself as well.
That's wonderful. So I want to kind of dive into the contents of the book now. Before we get into, and I really want to spend some time here where we talk about the history of different religious revolutionary movements. I really want to spend some time in that. But before we get to that, can you talk more about why there has been this long antagonism between religion and the left? You know, you've got in the back of your book, you've got a little quote from Marx that maybe is at least not necessarily maybe the foundation of why that antagonism exists, but it certainly is indicative of it. Can you talk a little bit more about why that antagonism between religion and the left has existed for quite some time?
Yeah, so I guess because a lot of the origin point of the modern left, it emerged at a time when institutional religion, typically did have a much closer relationship to the state and state power, you know, in your sort of your 18th and 19th centuries. And so to resist religion was in a sense to sort of to be resisting what was the dominance of power structure, not just informally in terms of what people believed, but in terms of, you know, the church as a sort of a system of domination over the rest of society. And I think that's just sort of, that's because that became quite embedded in the sort of the core sort of theoretical positions of the left, like you say, with Marx, with that sort of that famous phrase. It's been very difficult to disentangle. It's been there right in the core of things. But I think what I'm trying to do with the book, well, one of the many things I'm trying to do, but one important thing is to try and get people who have accepted that kind of anti-religious position on the left to realize that that it is kind of contextual, and that in this the context we find ourselves in now, it is actually much easier to disentangle those things and to try and understand how religion is actually functioning today and how it is actually used. Although, having said that, even in Marx's time, as I point out in the book, it wasn't just as simple as, you know, religious bad, non-religious good. It was very much like, you know, the first organization that Marx joined was a Christian communist organization. So even at that time, it's far more complex than I think a lot of people appreciate. And so, yeah, the book is in part trying to just to encourage people to think about this in a more sort of like nuanced and complex way, rather than, as is typical and has been typical for quite a long time on the left, is to think of religion in black and white terms.
I want to personally invite you to OrcCon 24 this July 8th through the 12th, 2024, at the Grand Targhee Resort in the Grand Teton Mountains of Wyoming. OrcCon is a time for you to meet and hear from some of your favorite open and relational thinkers, including Tom Ord, Trip Fuller, and Adam Clark. And if you register with the link in the episode description and use the promo code APeoplesTheology, you can receive $100 off of your ticket. I hope to see you there. Whenever I hear people on the left criticize religion, a lot of times, like, their criticisms are less about, like, Christians believe Jesus or God became incarnate in the person of Jesus, right? Like, that's a theological claim. Very few people on the left really seem to have issue with some sort of sort of theological claim like that. They may not believe it, but that's not their criticism. Or their criticism is not that religious people pray to God. Like, that doesn't seem to be the criticism. The criticism generally is some sort of criticism against the institutions that get propped up in religion, right? And so, for example, you've got like the Roman Catholic Church, which has probably more property and is the wealthiest entity probably in history. And that is the institution that they are criticizing, but not necessarily the totality of the religion itself, including its theology and its spiritual practice and whatnot. So it does seem to be really important for people on the left to understand that if they even do have criticisms of religion, to understand what parts of religion are they actually critiquing, because it doesn't seem like they sort of understand that there's a lot of different facets to religion, and the institutions are one of those things, and those generally are what I see to be the things that they are criticizing. Would you agree that there's some level of that needs to be really, that seems to be an important nuance for people on the left to understand?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, although, like, I agree that that is often what people, when you piece it apart, when you ask them, you know, you go through a conversation, you find out what their problem is, it is that. But they often then end up conflating that with the entirety of religion and just, you know, right, not understanding all these different sort of complexities and sort of imagining that there is, for example, a singular Christian perspective, rather than, ironically, like, looking at it in a more dialectical way, as, you know, a Marxist might think of it, and actually understanding that there are struggles within religion, religions, even single religious communities will have their differences, mm-hmm, and their conflicts. I mean, I think more and more people on the left are aware that there is such a thing as Christian socialism and Christian left now, because it's much, much easier on things like Twitter to you know, come across people. But I think it's still kind of unusual for a lot of people. They don't sort of seem to understand that there isn't just such a thing as, you know, a Christian perspective, particularly as they're often, you know, they'll often be seeing images of, you know, Christian nationalism, for example, and still just filing this away as Christian. And, you know, that's just sort of like inflating their pre-existing kind of notions that, you know, Christianity is a thing of oppression, rather than understanding, well, yes, that is a very big thing that's happening right now, but who is actually challenging those people? Oh, it's Christian leftists and Christian liberals and Christian socialists. And they are sort of, you know, that's an ongoing sort of conflict within that sort of social sphere. And so that's kind of, I think, what often gets missed, the complexity and the conflict that exists within these things, mm-hmm, understanding, you know, religion as, like, as you say, it is the institutions, but it's also people. It's also, and those people can be within or without of institutions. It's, you know, theologians, you know, priests. It's all kinds of different sort of people. It involves everything from the practices to the texts. There are so many different aspects that just sort of get clumped into a single thing, and that's why it becomes very difficult to have those kind of conversations when somebody has taken such an enormously complex social phenomenon or set of social phenomena, has collapsed them down into a single idea that you can just say yes or no to, mm-hmm, and often no in a very, very aggressive way. It becomes incredibly difficult to have those conversations. So I think encouraging people to understand that there are enormous differences, like you said, they don't have to change their beliefs or anything, but actually just to understand the complexity is a really important step.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I find that just historically has been true is that this conflation of all religions, first off, and then making different religions a monolith, has actually benefited especially conservative Christianity and the more conservative right-wing types of Christians. And the reason why I think this is because if, for example, the left thinks that to be a Christian means that you have to, you know, be a capitalist and you have to be anti-LGBTQ and yada, 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 so on and so forth, that actually benefits right-wing Christianity. And so I'm curious your thoughts around that, that this antagonism that has historically happened throughout the history of the left and religion or different religions has actually contributed to benefiting more conservative religious movements like right-wing Christianity. I don't know if you have thoughts on that, but it seems to actually benefit those types of movements.
Absolutely. I mean, the one thing that is required for resisting any kind of oppressive system, oppressive ideas, is organizing and solidarity between people, between groups, creating a united front against something. And this whole idea that there is just only, you know, this monolithic idea of religion as oppressive completely cuts off even the possibility of creating solidarity between the secular left and the religious left, which would be an enormously powerful thing for combating that kind of, you know, Christian nationalism or just general sort of like bigotry that is framed and through religious sort of terms. So it absolutely does, it shoots everybody in the foot, this kind of knee-jerk anti-religious sort of attitude from the left, because it stops the creation of those kind of movements, which could actually be much more effective in creating an alternative. The left in general needs to be able to promote and support and lift up people within, you know, within communities. They may often be, you know, completely alone as, you know, a single leftist surrounded by you know, Christian nationalists, Christian, you know, right-wing fundamentalists, and simply just leaving them just to, you know, on their own, to struggle on their own. That's completely contrary to what we should be doing. And so, yeah, it absolutely is of benefit to no one but the right.
I said I wanted to get into this, so let's get into the weeds of this. What are some of the best examples of these revolutionary movements that have been grounded in spirituality and religion? You mentioned, obviously, just a bit ago about the Haitian slave revolts. You also have the Latin American liberation theologians in the 60s and 70s. I'm even thinking about the Catholic worker movement in the U.S. What are some of these best examples, or the examples that you really want to bring out that you really are grounded in spirituality and religion, but have become very successful revolutionary movements as well? What are some of those really good examples throughout history?
Well, to be honest, I think one of the ones you mentioned, in Latin America, the liberation theology movement, but particularly I think what is quite important about that is it often gets talked about just in terms of the theology, in terms of sort of the writing, the intellectualism. But I think what was really important was how this became sort of organized into sort of real world sort of groups that were coming together and worshiping together and reading the Bible together through a liberation theology lens. It wasn't just about the ideas that were floating about and people writing books and articles or whatever. It was, what was important is that actually became embodied in collective action. And I think that's what really set it apart and actually enabled it to be quite a powerful and quite an influential movement that really had material effects.
What are some of those collective actions that you have found in your research that happened specifically that came out of that Latin American liberation theology movement?
So it was that sort of like base building that I can't remember the term for it, but there was a particular sort of organizational form where it was existing outside of the formal church, outside of the church hierarchy, and the sort of it was just sort of people would come together in their communities to worship together without the sort of the mediation of the church itself. And were allowing sort of their own readings of the Bible, of biblical stories, where they would share it and apply it to their own lives and try to understand it in terms of, you know, movements against oppression and how there are threads within the Bible that are relevant to sort of like everyday struggles, particularly around poverty. And that to me is the really important sort of like dividing line, is like trying to actually embody this in action. And these groups sort of like, you know, creating a network of these groups so that they are not just isolated localist groups, but that they actually can form some sort of like wider movement, which then has powers that are greater than, you know, the sum of all these groups. So that's mm-hmm. when it kind of emerges, if you will, into a much larger body that can have political power.
Mm-hmm. The reason why I love a lot of these movements is they recognize that there are many different parts to these movements, and everybody has their own gift and their own part to contribute to these movements. And so obviously there are certain people that are a little bit more theory based, and that's their gift. And then certainly there are some people who are better on, you know, boots on the ground, organizing, that kind of gift. And one of the things is sometimes you see people from either side of that kind of those different parts. You've got some of those theory people, and then you've got some of these action people, praxis people, and sometimes they sort of have an antagonism between them. And I think people from each one of those groups are best when they recognize actually all of these people, all of these different gifts are actually really important. You need the theory people and you need the praxis people, and these are two parts that are part of the machine that keeps this thing rolling. And so I think it's really great to see when those movements recognize that in people, that there are theory people, there are people that are more gifted in the praxis side of things, and they're not trying to make a dichotomy between each of these groups, but they actually recognize both of these groups are really important for this movement.
Exactly. Yeah. We need, obviously we need stuff to be done. We need people taking action, but we need to also step back and think about stuff and shape our ideas of, you know, how we're, you know, our critiques of the world and also our ideas of where it should be going and how we should be acting. And so the two have to be in conversation. I think where there's often a gap between the two is something I've tried to do actually myself, is to sometimes be a translator, like in the middle mm-hmm. of those two different kind of networks of people, because they mm-hmm. are sometimes they are often, you know, separate networks, like people doing stuff but not really having any interaction. I think it's quite important that we have sort of people that are kind of in the middle that try and translate one into the other. So I'm very in favor of, you know, very impenetrable theory, like to going as hard as you need to properly analyze what's going on. Some people will say, oh well, you know, if it's not, if this theory isn't accessible to the average working person, then it can't be revolutionary. I actually don't agree. Mm. As long as there is some means of translation, so as long as there's a flow one way and back the other way as well, as long as theory is actually also learning from what is really going on and what people are doing and how, when those ideas are put into action, what happens. And so as long as there is an overall communication, I'm absolutely in favor of, yeah, people doing what they do best and just finding a way of bringing together all these different ways of taking action, because writing and thinking and theorizing is a kind of action, as long as it is still articulated with, like you say, boots on the ground.
What are some maybe non-Christian religious and spiritual revolutionary movements that have happened throughout history? We just mentioned the Latin American liberation theology movement. Obviously, it was very distinctly a Catholic movement. Are there any non-Christian movements that you've researched and talk about in the book that are worth noting?
So there are interesting things around, for example, Buddhist socialism, and more recently, sort of, you know, you've got your sort of socially engaged Buddhism, which tends to be a little bit more liberal, but there was at one point quite a strong sort of actually sort of Marxist and socialist sort of Buddhist movements, like the Sennogyo in Japan, and yeah, there's like, it's one of the difficulties is there are often just little sprinklings, little moments here and there, sort of like in early Islamic history, you find these kind of like proto kind of anarchist movements and things like this, just as you have, like, you know, Gerard Winstanley in England as a Christian. And you find these kind of moments where you have lots of groups that will have sort of, you know, effectively communes, But because these are kind of outside of the dominant sort of historical narratives, they often weren't preserved in a lot of detail. There's a couple of ones in China as well that there's so little information about but it seems as though they were sort of like living in this kind of like these kind of proto-anarchist ways, which were resistant to the state. And there are so many examples of like movements that are outside and against the state, but which often there isn't a huge amount of documentation for. And so a lot of the examples that we'll find are actually ones where you can actually read a lot about them, are often in the 20th century. Like there were, Hindu socialist movements around, the fight against the British Empire. And it's always very interesting to see how the religion is articulated with the socialism. So one example is sort of around the Iranian Revolution, which is interesting because what came after the revolution has been, a lot of people are aware is this very kind of conservative theocracy, kind of which sort of overturned what was previously quite a westernized sort of seemingly sort of secular kind of society. Obviously, it was an Islamic society nonetheless, but a lot of people don't seem to realize that the revolution itself actually wasn't that kind of sort of conservative one. It was actually a workers' movement. Well, there were lots of different sort of aspects to it, but there was a strong aspect of it being a workers' movement. And this sort of like what came after this sort of theocratic sort of coup almost sort of just basically sort of took over the revolution. But there was a very strong sort of Islamic socialist aspect of that revolution around, particularly around the ideas of Ali Shariati. And this kind of often gets sort of just kind of brushed under the carpet, just kind of ignored in discussions about Iran. And we only sort of end up sort of looking at this kind of theocratic side of it. Again, sort of as we were talking about with understandings of religion in general or understanding of Christianity is not understanding the, or not looking for appreciating the different sort of conflicts within, understanding that movements actually have lots of different aspects to them, and they can have leftist and rightist aspects. So yeah, you can find lots of different examples. That's one that there is a lot more documentation about, and you can learn a lot more about it. But unfortunately, the further you go back, the harder it is to find these kind of lots of information about these elements. And I'm hoping at some point somebody will do a big historical project where they, go into the archives and find as much information they can about all these tiny little movements of tie them together into a larger narrative. Unfortunately, I'm not a historian, so it's a little bit outside of my purview.
This episode of A People's Theology is brought to you by United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities. Are you considering exploring your faith more deeply, or are you called to ministry but haven't found a seminary that is quite right for you? When you come to United, you join a community that is intentionally open, socially aware, and theologically adventurous. United's passion is equipping leaders to make real, lasting change in the world through their many different degree programs. Whether your vocation is in faith leadership, nonprofit leadership, academia, the arts, activism, or social entrepreneurship. And the best news is you don't have to uproot your life to attend seminary. United offers maximum flexibility to fit your schedule. Attend on campus or online, part-time or full-time. Their leading distance learning technology allows students to be active in the classroom and engaged with the United community. Want to learn more? Visit unitedseminary.edu/apeoplestheology or click the link in the episode description and receive a $1,000 scholarship when you apply and are admitted. United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities, training leaders to dismantle systems of oppression, care for the spiritual needs of a multi-faith world, and push the boundaries of theology. Again, one of the things that I think is so important for uncovering that history is, again, sort of reorienting this narrative that all religion is inherently conservative and inherently right-wing. When you see so many of these pockets and movements of these people, they might not be as popular of movements as you see in evangelical Christianity in America or whatever, but these movements have existed in different religious traditions throughout history, and those movements were grounded in those groups' theology and in obviously their religion. It wasn't in spite of their religion and in spite of their theology. It was because of their theology and religion that they were motivated to have these revolutionary movements within their communities.
Exactly, yeah, because you can find examples of where people have sort of become socialists and it's kind of been quite separate from their religion. But yeah, the most interesting are when those two are sort of wedded together and you end up with a sort of a re-understanding of, you know, one is looked at through the lens of the other. And this does happen.
Sort of along those lines, you know, I know that different religions are fundamentally different, right? I don't want, again, conflate Christianity with Islam or Islam with Buddhism. But in your study of these revolutionary movements that were grounded in religion, have you noticed any common theological themes between each of these traditions? I'm curious what that commonality may be, even though obviously, again, I don't want to attempt to like conflate any of these religious movements with each other. But yeah, are there any commonalities that you've noticed, even theologically? Again, because I think I really want to sort of drive home this point that people are a part of these movements because of their theology, not in spite of it. And so I'm curious if there's any sort of common theological themes that you've noticed between each of these different kinds of movements throughout history.
I think there seems to be quite a broad, there are very broad ways of interpreting, you know, religious texts and so on. And there are lots of different ways of going about it, and you do see some commonalities sometimes with, you know, sort of understanding the interconnections of things is a very common thing that comes out a lot. Understanding the power of, for example, if it's a, you know, a monotheistic religion, the power of a god to do anything, you know, anything is possible under God is mm-hmm. there are sort of, you can see reflections of that in different sort of terminology and in different religions. It's difficult to find like exact sort of reflections, like perfect kind of, you know, ways of linking them together. But there are little bits, you see moments of sort of crossover. I think that I tend to think that when there is an emphasis on dynamism and the possibility of change, and then you do see kind of like moments where things come together. But often it can often be a case of, you know, looking to religion as a means of survival as well, rather than any particular sort of like theological element. It's often how it is used. You can find a quite different sort of approaches which function in much the same sort of way, both in terms of, you know, steeling oneself against the immediate struggle to giving yourself some sort of like future image that one's striving towards, though the kind of the interaction of those of the sort of the present and the future is something that you see quite a lot, that and in terms of how religion functions in these kind of like these political movements.
One of the sort of maybe hypotheses I have is this idea that a lot of the most successful revolutionary movements throughout history have had some kind of core religious or spiritual group a part of it. You know, I'm thinking of like the civil rights movement in America, and even the precursor to that with the anti-slavery movements that happened in the 1800s in America, obviously were really grounded in many of the African slaves who were Christian, became Christian, and utilized that Christianity to sort of motivate them for that revolution. I'm curious, like, out of, you know, with all of these sort of successful movements that have happened throughout history, again, I think a lot of them have had some sort of grounding in religion. Do you think currently now, part of the reason why we don't see a very strong left movement, especially in America, is because of the fact that there's a lack of religion that seems to be involved in it? I'm curious sort of your thoughts. And again, I'm kind of speaking from an American perspective. Maybe it's similar or different in the UK and Europe, but I'm really curious, like, it just certainly there is not a strong left movement in America, especially. And I wonder if the sort of antagonism that the left has had in America, at least of recent, is part of the reason for the lack of success, is because of the lack of religion that is really grounded in it.
Certainly, I think there's a strong tradition in America, particularly as, I mean, I'm speaking as an outsider, so, right. But I see that there's quite a strong tradition of religiously sort of motivated rhetoric on the left and in progressive movements, so particularly as you say around Martin Luther King, for example, was a great example. That I still see moments of it, like. I saw a few years ago, I mean, she's getting increasingly unpopular on the left, but Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez I saw speaking in very kind of, religious tones in a way that was clearly very powerful. It was resonating with a lot of people. And I think the rhetorical power of religion is something that is underutilized. Particularly if you're in a context where lots of people are religious as well. I mean, I think it resonates a little bit differently in the UK because, as I say, we've secularized a bit, a few decades earlier. But even sort of like Jeremy Corbyn, he wasn't speaking in explicitly religious terms, but there was something about a lot of his rhetoric which drew on the same kind of sort of passion and the same kind of, in the book I talk about, I try to come up with a way of seeing spirituality which can encompass both the religious and a sort of a secular spirituality at the same time. And I think that kind of the combination of having something that's really emotive and really embodied, very sort of things which appeal to the heart in that very kind of that physical way, at the same time as we have this sort of sense of power beyond us, or power between us, and unseen possibilities around us, and when those are combined into here is an ethical direction, when those things come together, you have that can be religious or it can be non-religious, but it has that power in either sense. And I definitely think in a context where you still have a very religious sort of populace that you need them to be listening to, it is a massive failure to not be tapping into religious rhetoric to have that kind of power.
Yeah, I think, and again, not to say that there's a strong left movement in America, and especially at the government level, the federal government level, but I think of some of the like more well-known people that are more left in American politics, like Bernie Sanders, or you mentioned AOC, or even someone like Ilhan Omar, right? Like Bernie Sanders has a Jewish background, but you never hear him talk about his sort of Jewishness being a very significant factor for why he has the political philosophy that he does. You don't see that so much from AOC. You mentioned that she did at one point, maybe early on in her political career, but you don't see it so much anymore, of specifically her Catholicism and why that has, shaped her and formed her for why she believes what she believes. You don't see that much anymore from her. And you certainly don't hear that much from Ilhan Omar, who is a very devout Muslim. And so it's just really interesting that you've got a Jew, a Christian, and a Muslim who are all very left, at least in American terms, and none of them are really speaking very explicitly about why their religion forms their political beliefs. And I just think that is a grave mistake, considering the fact that so many people, especially in America on the right, are more than willing to talk about their religion and why their religion shapes their right-wing beliefs.
Exactly, yeah. And I think going back to MLK is quite a powerful example, because it's turning around a bit now, but throughout my life he was always just framed as just a liberal activist. That was it. When he was very much, he wasn't just a liberal, he was anti-capitalist, he even right. Even socialist, he said a few times, and he was obviously very clearly a Christian socialist. That was an enormous part of not just, I said about rhetoric, but I don't want to make that sound as though it's just for propagandistic purposes. He was a devout believer, and it was a thing that drove him ethically in himself. Mm-hmm. And it was because it was such a real part of him that it resonated when he spoke about it. And that has been, until fairly recently, that has just been kind of completely deleted from the image, at least as we got it over here. Maybe in the US it's been depicted differently, but that was always the image we were fed. It completely removed these two really important aspects of him. And I think reconnecting to that and saying, well, look, one of the most sort of successful activist movements in the history of the country is based on this. Why are we not only ignoring it now, but are we actively sort of, you know, still being antagonistic to religion when mm-hmm. it's such a huge part of the successes that we've had? So I think that's actually quite an important, you know, discursive kind of, you know, point that we can point to this period of history and say, look, we need to actually learn from this, mm-hmm. but in a way that, you know, has been ignored.
Right. I mean, even MLK's contemporary, Malcolm X, was both obviously revolutionary in his political thought, but also very much a devout Muslim, and probably would not have had the revolutionary political philosophy that he did had he not been a very devout Muslim.
Yeah, and just uncovering that, there's a brief mention in the book of around that time, there was actually kind of almost like a network of people in different countries that kind of came together around the fact that they were all sort of like, you know, what we would now call social justice activists, if you will, but also had a religious perspective, you know, mm-hmm. In Africa, in India, you know, it's, and that kind of moment has sort of been lost, and we don't seem mm-hmm. to have this kind of, even though we're much more, supposedly much more globalized world, and yet these kind of global connections seem to have, they don't seem to be quite as strong as they were at that moment. And mm-hmm. I think that was a huge part of how that moment kind of became globalized as well, because, you know, obviously it was about the particularities of the US context, but it has become this sort of like really powerful global emblem as well.
What's up, a People's Theology listeners? I would love for you to support the podcast. There are a few ways you can do that. First, sharing the podcast to others who you think would also enjoy it and find it helpful is a great way to support the podcast. It's like evangelism, but for something actually good. I really think the ideas explored on this podcast matter, and I believe they are worth sharing with others. Second, if you're not totally depraved and use Apple Podcasts like me, please give the podcast a 5-star rating and review. It might not seem like much, but every rating and review helps the podcast tremendously in a world more predestined by algorithms than by God. Third, please support my Patreon at patreon.com/Mason Meniga. It's like tithing, but for something actually good. This podcast takes a lot of time and energy to make, so supporting my work through Patreon is a great way to make sure this podcast can continue to be made. With all that said, please enjoy more inspiring and liberating theology. So, in the book, you also propose that, and I think this is really interesting, really intriguing, is you propose this materialist spirituality. And certainly there are going to be people on the left who may not necessarily want to kind of buy into or be a part of a particular religious tradition. And I understand that, and there's lots of good reasons for that. But for you, you don't believe that that necessarily should prevent them from still thinking that spirituality is a really important part of revolutionary work. And so you propose this materialist spirituality. Can you talk more about what you mean by this materialist spirituality and why it's important for revolutionary movements?
Yeah, so with the term, where I mean, I have this conversation in the book around the term materialism, because it actually has so many different meanings that often get conflated. You know, we have, there's the materialism, which is in no way conflicts with a religious perspective, the historical materialism of, you know, the world that we live in is the result of its histories and its processes and the struggle between classes. There's nothing about that which conflicts with a religious perspective. But then you obviously have the kind of the more metaphysical notion of materialism, where, you know, there is no supernatural world There is only the natural world, and you know that's often reduced to sort of, you know, atoms or what have you. So what I'm trying to do with what I'm presenting in the book, that is the part of it that is sort of aimed at more sort of like, you know, atheists or people with secular beliefs, is to say that spiritual practice can be built out of the natural world as well, so long as it's a view which is not reductionist, that doesn't reduce the world to just, you know, atoms, but is a holist one, the one that it focuses on how things emerge out of one another, out of a worldview that emphasizes the potential of things rather than just their sort of, you know, mute physicality. If we have a notion of the unseen that exists beyond the immediate, then we can build sort of spiritual belief around it in a way which is has a sort of still has an emotive power that is in some ways kind of equivalent to, you know, a religious spiritual experience. So one way that one can do this is the popularization, for example, of mindfulness practices, which have been sort of taken out, typically out of Buddhism, stripped of all their kind of really interesting ontology and interesting ethics, and then sort of presented as just this therapeutic tool. It's very right that this is being criticized, you know, the whole mindfulness trend. But the way that I see it is that actually there is something that we can engage with and swing it back in a different direction. If you have these embodied practices like meditation, but also like prayer, basically any kind of embodied practice which has been used or can be used for religious purposes, as long as if we take it rather than just using it as a form of therapy, but reconnect it into ontologies, metaphysics, ways of understanding reality, which we can then link into social critique. So, you know, Marxism underlying it is this sort of dialectical materialism, where we're seeing the world in terms of its processes, in terms of its interrelations, in terms of its conflicts and struggles, how things they don't typically use the word emergence, but how one thing comes out of another, how things are sublated. And if you can reconnect that into mindfulness practice, you know, you could do Marxist mindfulness. I didn't call it this, but I have run radical mindfulness groups before, which basically do your kind of, you know, your typical secular mindfulness thing, but then you're actually, you know, you're not just noticing the flow of your thoughts, you're noticing the flow of reality. And that in some ways is a return to, you know, how, you know, to actual Buddhist practice as well. But I mean, Marx himself actually did a little bit of meditation, so he was probably already noticing the connection between those two things. But that's one way. And then once you've connected this idea of, you know, doing embodied practices which make you aware of the processes and interconnections and all these sort of things, and that is, like I say, that underlies then the social critique, where we're looking at the processes that, you know, of capitalism and the interconnections. And so that's one way. There are lots of different ways. That's just one way that I've experimented with, that you can try and find ways of having some sort of spiritual observance, which is on the one hand still, you know, naturalistic and secular, but also ties into political movements. Like I say, this notion of spirituality is broad enough that if you're connecting powerful emotive embodied practices with a metaphysical sort of idea of the unseen beyond what is immediate, and then connecting that into, well, therefore I'm going to do this, you know, an ethical kind of drive, then you can have you can actually have quite powerful spiritual experiences.
It reminds me, you know, obviously I'm a Christian. I'm very willing to say that and admit that. And I'm also really influenced by Whiteheadian philosophy, Alfred North Whitehead, right? So I'm very influenced by process theology and process thought. And One of the things that I find interesting about process thought is that certainly there is a sort of religious side of it where it's a lot of process theologians and many of them believe in God. But then there is the philosophy side of Whiteheadian thought that and many of them are not even theists, much less a part of a particular religious tradition. But many of them are atheists, essentially. And yet they still have this metaphysical system with which they operate within and you know and adhere to that being the Whiteheadian metaphysics and for you know I've often thought like even if I were an atheist I would be interested in process theology because or process thought it, because like if everything is in relationship with everything then that should inform my politics and that should inform my ethics and so I often have thought that like even if I didn't believe in God I happen to do but if I didn't I still would find process metaphysics to be really compelling partly because of what it would shape me in, or the way that it would shape me in my politics.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of Whiteheadian sort of process thought is a big sort of influence in the book. And it's interesting what you're saying about how it's used as in both sort of religious and non-religious ways. I think it's a really powerful potential for pluralism in general, in different religions and non-religion to sort of to kind of come together around, it doesn't have to be exactly the same kind of very specific philosophical system. It doesn't have to be exactly, you know, process and reality, Whitehead. Right. But these kind of broad sort of metaphysical ideas, I think is a very, very powerful way of bringing together quite disparate modes of thought. It's something that the section of the book kind of very, very quickly sweeps over, you know, a variety of different sort of religious ontologies and how there are sort of these moments of connection between them of, you know, again, of process, of relation, of potential. And I think it's interesting because like metaphysics is often sort of considered by secular leftists as being, well, we don't do that. That's not, right. It's got no relevance to anything. That's just, you know, we're sitting around and thinking, we're not doing stuff kind of thing. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, those metaphysical perspectives, as you say, it links very, very strongly into how we understand the world politically as well. Mm-hmm. There is a metaphysical underpinning to, you know, all our thought right. And finding these kind of, these points that cross over within a metaphysical framework is very, you know, there's a lot of potential there, I think, that is underused in sort of creating connections between groups and different ways of thinking in order, whether we're thinking of this just in purely like religious terms in terms of creating religious dialogue and mutual transformation, or if we're thinking in terms of building political movements.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, the sort of atheistic metaphysics piece that you just brought up there reminds me. I've got a video on YouTube where I sort of kind of critique the sort of new atheist kind of folks, you know, like Richard Dawkins and Strauss and others. And one of my arguments about in that video is the fact that, you know, whether you're an atheist or a theist, you're still operating out of a certain kind of metaphysics. There are some metaphysics that allow the possibility of God, and there are some that don't. But regardless, you're operating out of metaphysics. And so that connects to this point that, you know, regardless of what you believe about God or if you're a part of religion or not, there's some sort of operating metaphysics with which you live your life that informs your ethics, that informs your politics. And even these atheistic left movements have some sort of metaphysics. And they may not be aware of what those metaphysics are, but they certainly have an operating metaphysics. And I think it's really important for people to, again, whether they're religious or non-religious, whether they're theists or atheists, to recognize what those metaphysics, what the metaphysics with which they're operating or want to, what metaphysics they want to operate with, I think is just really, really important for these movements.
Exactly. Yeah. And something I try to do in the book as well, because I mean, we could get into sort of it always feeling like it's just about dialogue between groups, between, you know, atheists and religious people. But I'm very keen, once you've got in like beyond sort of dialogue, once you've got at least got to that point where people aren't just completely cutting off from one another, I'm actually really interested in the mutual transformation aspect as well. How we kind of move forward together in a way which we're not just two separate kind of atoms moving together, but we are actually kind of, we're entangled. And something that is probably difficult for atheists in the book to do, but I try to make people a little bit uncomfortable in it, is sort of say, okay, admit to yourself, like if you've come from, a Christian background and, you want to sort of build a spirituality around, just the scientific natural world, does religious kind of symbolism, is it actually emotionally powerful for you? Are you actually just rejecting it because it's so powerful to you? And not saying, oh, you have to convert to Christianity, but what happens? I'm asking people to experiment when there's nobody around, when no one's going to judge you. Just experiment. What happens when you visualize the world, the universe as God? What does it actually make you feel? What happens if you just try and take it seriously, just for half an hour? What happens in your body? And if you notice, like, just the it, if you sort of basically do experiments on yourself, experiment with how you are, embodied in the world, and you can sort of, observe yourself as a system, realize that you are like an imperfect being. Even if you want to be the most perfect atheist, you may well have grown up surrounded by, images of Jesus as a great man, and you actually do have an emotional connection to it. If you do that, does it empower you? Does it make you feel better? Do you feel happier? And if it does, how are you going to reconcile that with your complete rejection of religion? So I'm sure most people will be like, no, I'm not trying that. But I want to encourage people, and maybe if anyone's listening who doesn't believe in God but is sort of intrigued by this conversation, is, well, just try it. Like, just try conceptualizing the universe in terms of God. Even if it's, the kind of God that I talk about in the book is much more this kind of, like I said, process theological one, where God is, it's how we talk about the infinite creativity of everything, of how I like to think of God in terms of the integration of past, present, and future. It's the past is, all of everything that's ever happened held together in all of the structures around us. It is the constant flowering of the present, which is, even a mute object in front of us is in process because it is constantly being, created into re being brought into reality out of its potentials, and the store of all the infinite number of things which could be, which the entire unseen world of what will be the future, all of that integrated, that is one way of looking at God, this sort of God which to an extent is the world around us, but is more than the world around us, in that it includes all of this completely unseen, unconditioned being. If you start thinking of the universe in terms of that, like we're saying, process metaphysics can have the sort of the atheist interpretation and the religious interpretation, and there's actually not a huge leap between the two. So if you've got on board with the one, just experiment with the other and see where it takes you, because ultimately what is important is that we have ways of empowering ourselves to take action and to feel good in how we live in the moment. And that's what is important.
Graham, last couple questions. The tagline of my podcast is Exploring, Inspiring, and Liberating Theologies. So how do you hope Red Enlightenment inspires and liberates its readers?
Yeah, so I guess in a number of ways, I hope on a personal level it encourages people to find ways of having more sort of intense experience. And this isn't, I've been talking about, aiming at people without religious views, but equally, people can, have a religious background, but they may have lost or never even found a very strong spirituality in terms of, the actual experience of God or experience of whatever it is. And so, yeah, encouraging people to intensify their experience on in a sort of immediate personal level is something I hope. And when I say intensify, I mean obviously in a positive way. I don't want people to feel extremely anxious after reading my book.
Right.
But finding a way, you know, cultivating joy, cultivating a sense of belonging in the universe. And that's just on a purely personal, spiritual level. But I hope it also encourages people to communicate and to dialogue and to find connections with communities that they are currently cut off from, and through that to create a stronger movement that can fight against all of the oppressions that people are facing.
Lovely. Last question, Graham, how can listeners get connected to you and your work, and where should they get the book?
So the book is on sale from Repeater Books. You can get it on their website and, you know, the usual sort of online places. If you want to get in contact with me, I mainly on, well, Twitter and Instagram, I guess. I generally just post absolute trash, though. I'm not particularly interesting online. But if you really want to, it's On A Life Glug on Twitter or Instagram. And there is actually, there technically is a Red Enlightenment Instagram account as well, which I am occasionally posting things on there. So I guess if you're interested in specifically in the book, you can get me there.
Lovely. Well, thank you, Graham, so much for chatting more about the book. I think it's such an important book. I don't have a lot of listeners that come from, or maybe I do. I mean, maybe a lot of my listeners are atheists. I have no idea. But certainly a lot of my listeners are interested in these sort of revolutionary movements, the left kind of world. And I just think it's so important for theology and religion and spirituality to be embedded in these movements. I really do think that work is so, so crucial. And so for a book like this, I think is just really a really good summative way of kind of how I've thought about this. So thank you so much for writing it and sharing a little bit more about it.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can get connected with Graham and his work in the links in the episode description. Thank you again for listening to another episode of A People's Theology. If you liked what you heard, please give the podcast a 5-star rating and review. Also, please support the podcast at my Patreon at patreon.com/MasonMeniga. And remember, friends, go and be the theology to the world that inspires and liberates.